Hi, I'm Meryl McDonald. 27 years ago, I founded my firm Gegg & McDonald on the premise that organizations don't transform, people do. Since then, as we've worked with many of the world's most admired global companies to navigate the human struggle of change, one thing has remained true. Leadership matters. A lot. Let Go and Lead is a podcast about what it takes to be a leader and how great ones balance the head and the heart to transform the companies that transform the world. That's why I'm especially excited to be talking with Tim Gabel, the president and CEO of RTI International. Tim led RTI, a research institution, through unprecedented turbulence, and he did more than navigate disruption. He seized the moment to deliver true transformation. His story is a masterclass in embedding purpose throughout the organization, in making tough decisions, and in putting humans at the center. Whether you're leading a team, a company, or just beginning to tap into your own leadership identity, there's something here for you. So get comfortable and get ready to let go and lead. Hi, Tim. I'm so happy to have you on Let Go and Lead. Thank you so much for agreeing to join us.
Well, thank you so much for having me, Meryl. I'm really looking forward to our conversation.
So am I. I have so many things I want to ask you about, you know, and what I know you've been the CEO of RTI International since 2022, but you've been with the organization over four decades. So that's something I definitely want to come back to. But before we start, tell us about RTI International. It's such an incredible organization. I want to make sure all of our listeners really understand what you do.
Well, I'd be happy to do that. So RTI International is a scientific research institute. We're based in the Research Triangle Park of North Carolina. Many folks are aware of that region. But RTI was established as the anchor tenant of the Research Triangle Park way back in 1958. At the time, the state of North Carolina was 49th out of 50 states in terms of per capita income. Low-income state at that time. And really, the only three industries in the entire state were tobacco and furniture and textiles. And yet the points of the triangle, what they call the Research Triangle Institute, are Duke University, the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, and NC State University. So the state had an issue of brain drain. You had great graduates coming out of great universities and no jobs. And so the vision was to create a region here in the Research Triangle Park of what they called it now, sort of a research hub. And so RTI was established as the first organization. Our governance structure is overseen by those three universities, although we're a completely independent organization. And then no company would have to be the first ones in the park. So they could market the park and try to bring R&D into this region and basically an economic development play. And so from an initial tranche of 180 acres, we have a big campus, and $500,000 back in 1958, we've now grown to our revenue in the most recent completed fiscal year, $1.2 billion in sponsored research. We do a wide range of things from health research and everything from medicinal chemistry, developing drug compounds and the like, to really understanding the payment schemes of the U.S. healthcare system, as well as working in life sciences more broadly. We work in energy technology and we develop new technologies to advance the energy sector. We have a great history of working in the fields of education and environmental impact and so forth. So we do a very wide range of things, applied research, less than what I would call basic research.
That's really amazing. I mean, when you think about the breadth and depth of that, you must have a really interesting employee population and very diverse, I would imagine.
Lots of PhDs. Lots of advanced degrees here at RTI, but folks that come from high-profile universities that you may have heard of to increasingly we're seeing a workforce that's skilled coming out of community colleges. And a lot of the skills that are being developed even in the community college sector. We have so wide range of people.
And do people specialize in a certain type of research or do they cross-pollinate or how does that work?
You know, it's some of both. I mean, we have a lot of PhDs that are very, very deep in their particular area, whether it's substance use disorder or lead in drinking water or whatever. So very narrow, very deep. And then we've got a lot of people that are you know, data scientists, data managers, project managers, and so forth, that are very multidisciplinary. We have a phrase we use, many other companies probably do as well. We say one RTI. And part of what our core competencies are really delivering on big, complicated programs. And you need multidisciplinary folks together, and you need connective tissue and folks that can span those boundaries and so forth. So we have some of both, I guess, kind of T-shaped, if you want to think of it that way.
And so, you know, I mentioned earlier, you've been with RTI for 4 decades. So I'm sure you've seen many areas of the company. Tell us a little bit about your journey.
Well, it's so, yes, I've been here.
You probably started as a toddler, right?
I did. I wasn't quite born here, but no, I'm from Wyoming originally. And my senior year in college, my advisor, I was a statistician, undergraduate degree in statistics. And my advisor was on sabbatical working at RTI my senior year. And he knew I was not ready to go to graduate school at that point. And so the RTI had won a new program funded by the EPA, studying the use of pesticides on farms. And so I got hired, drove cross country, and thought I'd be here a couple of years before I figured out what my grad school plan was going to be. But after a bit of focus more on playing softball and volleyball and not really career-minded, I had a mentor of mine say, you know, have you thought about getting an MBA, which is something that I had expressed some interest in. And so I ended up going to graduate school. RTI funded me. I felt very blessed to have gotten my MBA through kind of a tuition reimbursement program, went to school at nights while I worked during the day. And so at the end of the day, I ended up on a general management track. And over the course of my time at RTI, I've led a number of our business units in different areas. And then having led our largest business unit from 2012 to 2022 and being, you know, we grew substantially, all of that portfolio.
Oh, you're being very, very humble. I think you almost doubled it, as I recall.
We did. It was great. Yeah. And, you know, I mean, we just, and it was very interesting to me as a leader because, in that formative time running the biggest business unit at the organization, you feel that weight of obligation and responsibility, because if we didn't do well, it was going to be, you know, challenging for the entire organization. And because we did very well and doubled in size over that period of time, I think ultimately that contributed probably from the board's perspective to me getting the nod to take on the CEO role starting in 2022 when my predecessor retired.
What was that transition like? Because, you know, you mentioned you ran the biggest business unit, but in my experience, there is a big difference between being the number two and being the number one. Find that to be the case? Yeah. Yeah.
Yes. I mean, I'd been at RTI my whole career, so I didn't have to learn the organization. Uh-huh. Per se. I mean, I knew the other leaders in the other business units and as peers and so forth. But when you realize that you are sitting in, you know, kind of that top seat chair, I think the weight, you feel that. I felt it.
Yeah.
Fortunately, I had a fabulous boss in our former CEO who had worked with me over the years. We had worked closely. You know, I had some development areas. I felt not well equipped to kind of take on the board and the governance side of things. Some of the administrative oversight that I hadn't really had a lot of involvement with over my career. I'd always been on the business unit side. And so, I was named the successor about 3 months before taking over the job. And so we were able to orchestrate a quick succession in my former job. And then I was able to spend a couple months shadowing Wayne, my predecessor. And that was great. And I would say our board was very, I had a good relationship with many of the board members, but not a deep relationship with them. And so the chair of the board spent a lot of time with me. And, I think it went pretty smoothly.
What would be some advice you'd give people now, having gone through the transition of you transitioning to CEO plus transitioning your successor into your job?
Well, I think, one of the things, I guess, advice I would give is don't be afraid to ask questions. Don't be afraid to consider yourself learning. You know, it's not really a fake until you make it kind of moment. It's okay. But I'll tell you the best advice that I was given. And what we were blessed to have as a board member, a gentleman by the name of Bob Ingram. And you can Google Bob Ingram. He was the CEO of GlaxoSmithKline, tremendous leader. And I never forget the first thing he told me is, Tim, you be you. Don't try to be Wayne. Don't try to be somebody else that you've seen as a successful CEO. You be you. You know, figure out what works for you and learn from others, of course, but you have to be yourself. That's proven to me over and over and over again to have been great advice. The other piece of advice that I got from one of our other board members who was a remarkable, in fact, he's just stepped off of our board. John Moldering was the superintendent at West Point. He was a flag officer general in the Army, remarkable leader. But his, when I shared with him kind of my leadership values and that sort of thing that I always share with my teams, he said, well, I've got one more for you. When in charge, take charge. And his, you know, his point to me was, you've been a peer to these other folks, you know, you're now stepping into a role that's above them. You've got to take charge. Don't feel like that relationship isn't going to change, because it did change. When you move from peer to boss, it does change. And I gave the same advice to the person that succeeded me in my prior role. You know, you're moving, it was an internal succession. You're moving from peer to boss. And so I thought both of those were great pieces of advice that I was given. And then I've subsequently shared with others.
They are really great pieces of advice. I'm thinking about, too, when you say you be you, I know you're a real believer in blending scientific like rigor into your leadership. And I'm very intrigued by that, because so many people think of leadership as an art and they forget that there's a real science to it as well. And can you just tell us a little bit about how you go about that?
Yeah, well, as you can imagine, the culture of our organization is a scientific research institute. We hold as a core value, you know, high quality, the precision of science. You know, science oftentimes is a very black and white sort of aspect. And I've always believed that you can develop as a better leader. There is, in fact, science and art. I've learned and tried to, you know, I'm a voracious reader of many leaders, but I also recognize that a lot of the art in leadership is recognizing that you're living, especially in the CEO role, you're living in a lot of gray zone. And I remember somebody told me, or I read somewhere, you know, when you're CEO, most of the decisions you need to make more like a soccer goalie than a brain surgeon. And so you have to recognize that you're making decisions that don't have a lot of clarity. Sometimes there's a lot of ambiguity. And so what I've tried to do is make sure that we've got operational excellence in our administrative groups, in our business units. We pay attention to key performance indicators. Even though we're a nonprofit organization, we don't have donors or anything like that. We operate as a professional services business model, and we rely on metrics and sort of indicators on the health of the business and the health of the workforce and our client relationships. So the science of being an effective leader is knowing when to kind of rely on data and use data in your decision-making. But the art side of it too is recognizing that, you know, I'm a fan of Colin Powell's leadership style, and he's got a rule of 40 to 70%. And if you've got enough data within that 40 to 70% certainty range, you know, Colin Powell's advice is decide and go. And I think particularly right now, you know, the world is living in a time where the pace is so fast, the disruption is so sudden that you can't wait around for the perfect answer. You have to be willing to say, don't let perfect be the enemy of good. Let's move forward. And if it's a two-way decision where you can make a decision and find out it didn't work out and reverse and go back out, that's a great approach. Sometimes you're making very big decisions that are hard to unwind. And so we spend more time thinking about some of those, you know, investment business cases and so forth.
But. Right. But, you know, to your point, rarely do you have all the information that you need to make the decision, right?
Right.
So I think you kind of answered this, but how do you think that applies to companies that aren't scientific based?
Well, I think the applicability really crosses many different sectors and so forth. I think that especially for leaders, I would say for leaders that have, you know, most organizations are built on the success of the people that are in them. And so how do you help people see the success and the vision going forward while simultaneously think about the facts that are in front of you? You know, one of the things that we've tried to adhere to is something called the Stockdale paradox. And Admiral Stockdale was a very, is quite famous. He was a POW in the Vietnam War and survived one, you know, a very traumatic experience. But his philosophy was you can never stop facing the cold, hard facts that are in front of you. What is the reality of the situation while holding also onto that hope and that confidence that you're moving in the right direction and it's always going to go well. And so trying to balance that sense of hope and optimism and positive energy in the organization with, you know, the facts in front of you. And I think that's applicable across industries, across companies. That's not unique to a scientific research institute. I think that rule, that Stockdale paradox, can be applied in many different ways.
Yeah. And I think it really helps your organization because they want to know you're optimistic and have a vision, but they don't want to think you're Pollyanny either. They want to know, you understand where we are. Yeah.
I think honestly, you know, I worked with an executive coach some years back. I've worked with coaches over the years. And this one had me document my leadership values that I could share with teams that I lead, that I could share with the organizations. And number one on my leadership values list is transparency. And I think staff deserve honesty. Staff diverge. I mean, there's always going to be confidential things you can't talk about, but the more transparency you can give to the organization about, you know, not just why we're doing what we're doing, but kind of some of the insight into how we're thinking about things and so forth, it can establish a trust bond that's very important. Because even as you cast vision about where we're going and you know, the hope and the optimism and all that kind of stuff, as you say, and especially in an organization like ours, we got very highly educated, very, very smart people in this organization. They, you know, they've got their own sort of BS detectors or whatever you would call it. I mean, they want honesty and they want truth.
Evidence, right?
Yeah, or otherwise. We as a leader, I've tried to lean into that.
So, you know, talking about transparency, you certainly had an opportunity to lean on that heavily a couple years ago. I remember shortly after you were CEO, you had dramatic funding cuts from the federal government and had to go through just an incredible turnaround of the organization. What was that like?
Yeah, that was very much uncharted waters, I will say, because as I say, my prior job, I had, you know, doubled our organization size. We had grown, you know, you've got ups and downs always, but
yeah.
In this case, we're about 80% funded by federal government research and 20% in the commercial markets. And so, you know, for a long time, we've known that we might be a little heavily weighted on the federal side, but at the same time, we were growing, we were thriving, we were succeeding and so forth. And so when the disruptions hit in terms of some change in priorities of the current administration and some of the things that we had been very, you know, some of the international work, for example, as the U.S. federal government has reassessed its thinking and priorities around federal, you know, foreign assistance, we experienced almost, you know, instantaneous reduction of about 200 of our projects. And so, wow. You know, projects we had worked really hard to compete for and win and carry out and so forth because the client's priorities had shifted. And so about 35% of our backlog of work basically was swept away over a matter of months. And so obviously we had to react to that. We had to pivot and think about how do we shut down a lot of projects and so forth. And so, but what we did, and I'm very so proud of our organization that we were able to do this, we had a work stream that was managing that disruption and another group that said, you know what, this is a, never let a good crisis go to waste, right? This is a fabulous opportunity to really implement some right-sizing, to break down some of the silos that we had in the organization. You know, any successful organization starts getting a silo effect if you're not careful. And so what we did is we completely redesigned the organization starting about the 1st of May. By September 30th, we succeeded in restructuring the organization. We brought in some next generation leaders that we had been grooming, put them in bigger roles. One of my visions had been when I took over the CEO role, RTI had never had kind of a growth function. I mean, we still don't have a chief growth officer, but we had had a very decentralized individual scientists chasing their own project kind of model. And I said, this is the perfect time to stand up a centralized business development function with a centralized marketing operation to really drive our growth forward. And so I think we saw that, we chose to see that not just as a challenge, but as an opportunity. And I think my views on organizational resilience is you're always going to have challenge, but how do you come through a challenge the better for it and a stronger organization and more positioned for the future? And so that's what we tried to do. I became kind of the communicator in chief, and we really had to help our staff see, because we had to lay off about 35% of our workforce. We had 6,000 employees at the time, and we had to do that in a matter of months. But we did it in a way that I think was respectful to our staff. In fact, I was out in our Colorado office last week. One of the people that came to a social event was one of our former employees. And I was deeply touched by her words, because she said, "I just got to tell you, I can't imagine a more humane way of being laid off than how you all handled this for me. And I'm just so grateful." This is somebody that lost her job. And she was telling me how grateful she was for how we as an organization helped her manage through that. And so I'm very proud of that. And if you can't tell, because I really think it's incumbent on leaders to set the tone. And if you set the tone of all negative, if you set the tone of we're in crisis management, if you set the tone for we just have to survive this, you're missing an opportunity. And I feel like we took the opportunity to position our organization for a very strong future, which we're very bullish on.
And, you should be proud of it. You should be really proud of it. And so often there's that saying that leaders set the weather, right? When you talk about the tone. And how did you keep yourself just sort of all together? Because I would imagine of those 36% or 35% you laid off, there were probably people you grew up with in the organization.
Oh, gosh.
That must be so tough.
It was so hard, honestly, to say goodbye to some of the people that I'd worked decades with. And at the same time, I think the leader does set the weather. So for me personally, I mean, what rejuvenates me is I'm not a very good golfer, but I love to play golf. I tried to keep that pattern in place. I go to a fitness center and I work with a trainer once a week. And I tried to keep that, I tried to keep healthy and try to keep my brain not 24/7 focused on the challenge that we were facing. But I won't deny that there was a very sentimental part of people knowing that they might have been, close to retirement, not ready to retire, or people that I had known over the years. And again, we just tried to be as respectful and as humane as we could. We stood up a special fund, an employee assistance fund, and our organization put $2 million into that fund. We let it be a matching fund. I tried to be the lead donor and so forth, so that even after severance was over, for some of these folks, we recognize there's so many people on the job market that they can apply for grants. It's managed by a third-party organization. But what gave me uplifting, kind of experience is how many people were expressing, like the one, the young woman that I mentioned a minute ago, that they understood this was, due to a lot of external factors. And while they weren't happy about losing their job, they were very grateful to having been part of an organization, a mission-driven organization that really cares about people around the world, cares about our employees.
And how did you tap into your purpose to really continue focusing on going forward?
Yeah. So our mission statement, we're very mission-driven, as I said, and our mission statement is to improve the human condition by turning knowledge into practice. And so part of what we tried to do, and I tried to do, in keeping the spirits of our staff up as they were facing, great challenge and projects being canceled and so forth, was to say, listen, you can't forget the world needs RTI. The world needs RTI. And when I became CEO in 2022, one of the things I had experienced over almost 40 years at that point was we were so decentralized, it was hard to really find a common, we've got a common mission statement, but to find a common goal that we could work toward. And so we set about trying to figure out what would work for the whole organization. And we settled on what we called our North Star goal. And we established our North Star goal that said by 2030, RTI will positively impact the well-being of 1 billion people through science-based solutions. Now we set that goal without knowing anything like a baseline of where we were, anything like that, but we established a process by which we would track our impact. And lo and behold, even with all the disruption that we had last year, we crossed the 1 billion mark 5 years ahead of time. That became something we could celebrate, something we could talk about with our staff, but we tried to always anchor back to our mission and to our North Star goal. That's why we exist. You know, we don't exist to give dividends to shareholders. We don't have any shareholders. We exist to advance science, but with a purpose toward improving the human condition. And the staff that we recruit here believe in that mission. There's not a person in our organization that couldn't tell you that's our mission. And so being able to remind staff that what they do matters, we ask every one of our staff members, whether it's one of our facilities members, whether it's one of our payroll department people, or one of our senior scientists that leads big projects, write down how you contribute to improving the human condition and your role in helping us get to 1 billion people. And then we shared those stories around the organization so people could see, you know, we're all in this together. We're really working as one team, trying to strive towards something bigger than ourselves. And that's a very powerful, very, very powerful thing if you can find it in an organization. If you can unleash that sense of purpose in people, in my experience, you know, you get every ounce of effort they have to give.
And it is such a wonderful purpose. Yeah, it's really terrific. So the second to the last question I'm going to ask you is, as you know, our podcast is called Let Go and Lead. And so as a tradition, I always ask my guests, what do you think leaders most need to let go of?
First of all, it's a great question. And I love that notion of letting go, because there's so many directions you can take that. I mean, for me, I would say, and I kind of hinted at this as a leader, especially as an executive leader, you've got to let go of that pursuit of perfection, because you are not going to be perfect. You're not going to get everything right. You can't agonize over what you get wrong or spend time dithering over trying to ensure. So the first thing I would say for leaders is let go of feeling like there's a pursuit of perfection here. And then the other thing that I would say is let go of the past. Let go of thinking that what got us here will get us there. Let go of that notion of really feeling like you're encumbered by either the process has been established or the rules that we have. You know, open your mind to the future and orient toward the future and try not to get pulled back into the way we've always done things or stuck in some of the process sorts of things that we've always had. And that can be a very freeing, thought provoking kind of way of doing things, especially if you're also willing to not chase perfection and say, we can experiment. We can try some things differently. We can do some different things. So that's sort of a two-pronged response, I guess, in terms of what leaders can let go of, in my judgment.
Yeah, no, I love that. And it's so difficult, right, to let go, particularly in the areas where you have the greatest expertise, but often that expertise no longer serves you. So.
Right. Or you get stuck thinking about efficiency. Well, if we change how we do this, I mean, there's going to be a lot of new learning curves and a lot of things, but no progress gets made if you just keep doing things the same old way. Right. So.
Yeah. Well, Tim, thank you so much for your time. I really appreciate it. This was just a terrific conversation.
Oh, I've enjoyed it very much, Merrill. I love your podcast and your videos that I've watched. And just honored that you would invite me to come talk with you and let your audience kind of get some of my thoughts. So I appreciate that.
Well, the honor is ours. Thanks again.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks for listening to this episode of Let Go and Lead. I hope you enjoyed this conversation as much as I did. If you found this episode insightful, please follow us on Spotify and Apple Podcasts and subscribe to us on YouTube. And don't forget to check out past episodes and interviews on GaganMacDonald.com. Thanks for joining, and see you on the next episode of Let Go and Lead.